Welcome to the Third Hour, a Latter-day Saint home study podcast. This season, we're discussing the Hebrew Bible. Our goals? To improve our appreciation of the gospel, to investigate the scriptures more thoroughly, to discuss tricky passages, and to build our faith. Some of our talking points will be familiar. Others will sound new. That's okay. Together, we'll learn something new about the Hebrew Bible, no matter our starting level. Welcome again to the Third Hour podcast. We're glad to have you. Thank you for joining us for episode 46 of the Third Hour podcast.
Reap the whirlwind.
Reap the whirlwind. Thank you, Amanda.
You're welcome.
I'm your host, Taylor.
Amanda.
I'm Andrew.
This week we are covering the book of Hosea. Amanda, you want to tell us what happens in this? Was it 14 chapters, right?
Yeah.
Hosea starts with an allegory about his wife having affairs with other men, but it's really about Israel being unfaithful to God. Then we get oracles about idolatry, immorality, corrupt priests, and reliance on foreign nations. So Israel will be cut off, but if they repent, they'll be forgiven. And we're done.
Nice.
You want to know what my impression is?
Yeah.
My impression is that I was relieved to see that Andrew had so few notes. Because, like, multiple times I went back and was like, I feel like that didn't say very much. I got to read it again. And then I read it again, and I was like, I feel like this repeated the last chapter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this was a great episode of the Third Hour.
This is one of those rare sections where I feel like I kind of wish I was back in my King James. That the King James was really good at saying no things, but making it sound beautiful. Mm-hmm. Whereas what we read last week was just beautiful. Like, even in the NRSV, the use of language and the phrasing, like, it was just so well
written. Yeah, Amos was amazing.
Yeah. Whereas this, so I came in kind of like stoked for this, looking
here.
For Amos.
You should have warned us, Andrew. All right. I'm just kidding.
And
good for me to form my own opinion and then be relieved when I see it matches yours.
Well, you're not wrong. But yeah, so
you
like,
you can see I'm a real independent thinker.
As I was reading through this, it was like, this is fine. But this could definitely benefit from some convoluted Shakespearean language.
It's a hard source. Like, this is super fragmentary. So, like, even King James has some great turns of phrase in here, but it's still kind of not great. I don't know if I know of an English translation of this I like all that much, to be honest. Mm-hmm. Like,
an English translation you like because they're all boring or because you feel like they don't represent the text well?
Both, but the first is also a problem of the original.
Yeah.
This is a really tough text. So with Amos, we got a really good sense of its composition.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this one, you know, it had four sections. They were all kind of really well delineated. We had some narrative. This one, you do have narrative, but like there, you really can't tell if it's allegorical or real.
Yeah.
Like, because he's commanded to take a faithless wife. He divorces her and then buys her out of slavery again. And okay. Did he?
Right.
Like, did he really name his kids like faithless child? Like,
yeah.
And so it's really,
so you hope it's an allegory.
Yeah.
Otherwise you have problems both with the prophet and the God who ordered this stuff.
Yeah, and there's also like sections that are just so very patently and obviously written later, by an editor, like kind of sections where it refers to Judah's captivity as well, mm-hmm. as Israel's. Even the opening where it talks about like it. So it says the word in that superscription that the word of the Lord comes to Hosea in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah. Why are they kings of Judah? It's not even framing it for a northern audience. It's framed for Judahites. And so the whole thing is really weird. The the second section, which is just long and rambly, isn't broken into discrete sections as clearly as Amos was. Now, there are discrete sections, but it's really hard to delineate. Also, like, the chapters don't line up with them. Like, it'll just pick up in the middle of a chapter until the middle of the next chapter, and that's, like, a discrete thought unit. And so the whole thing is a challenging text, but it's not a challenging text that's all that rewarding to pick into.
Yeah, it's not challenging in the good way.
Yeah, like, you're not, like, digging for nuggets. You dig, and then you're like, oh, really? It's just, like, a sexist metaphor.
Yeah.
For 14 chapters. And, you know, and we're always cautious, of course, about bringing our values to the text and et cetera. And this is useful in that it reveals the way that marriage was considered in its time period.
I thought that, actually. That's an important piece to recognize, like, that God, Israel, husband, wife, that's the...
Yeah.
Yeah, in case you hadn't gotten that lecture before in any of the reading that we've done before...
Yeah, and that's kind of the problem is but this is important. I think it is important for us to read. In part because it's very likely that Hosea was a real person. A lot of this text does seem to be very old. It seems like he was writing in the generation after Amos. So we have gone from Amos was writing kind of at the height of the prosperity of Israel, and now we have Hosea who's writing when they're under threat by Assyria. So that change in their political state may be reflected in the tone of his piece, in some of the metaphors that he chooses to deploy rhetorically, the type of poetry he's writing. It's more apocalyptic, of course. And then, of course, it's just very hard for us to pick apart, too, though, how much later authors are adding to it.
Yeah.
How much hindsight there is. And you can kind of do, like, plenty of scholars have gone through and done a verse by verse thing, right? Where this is probably original and this is later. And we'll do a little teeny bit of that just to sort of illustrate some points. But we, by no means does it need to be exhaustive because there's just not that much to draw out of the well.
Yeah. So remind me, do we think Amos is a real person too?
Yes. We think that the literary prophets, we do think that at some point that we have the non-literary prophets, right? We have like Nathan and all these other prophets who are clearly appearing in the story. They're important, but they don't actually preserve any written text for us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we have these literary prophets and for the most part, we do think they are real. That someone wrote this stuff and handed it down. Was his name really Hosea? You know, who cares?
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter.
Right. It's not like that's the Hebrew pronunciation anyway.
Yeah. And it's not like he's saying he's Paul, right?
With
Paul, we really have to worry about, is this Paul or not?
Right.
We don't need to worry about this here. It says it's Hosea. Let's take it at its word and use that name. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So it's likely that this is somebody who's writing a generation after whoever the person was who was writing Amos.
Yeah. Right.
And we can use that as a useful source to trace the tone of how people were thinking about Israel as it approached their decline. That during their prosperity, Amos basically writes a condemnation of prosperity gospel, in a sense, right? And then Hosea comes along and, well, now that things aren't going so great, he can't pin their problems on things going great. So he's going to pin it on other problems.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a lot more in line with the Deuteronomist. In a way, this might be the beginning or a parallel to that development. That he's kind of coming in and saying, well, the problem is idolatry. But there's still a few crucial differences, right? For one thing, it's not just the kings. He's going to also condemn the priests very roundly. That's way different from the Deuteronomist. He's going to accuse the ordinary folk, the small folk. That's different from the Deuteronomist. But this still fits into the literary tradition of the literary prophets quite well in other ways. So
I'm trying to remember, too, if there's I wasn't really looking for this, so I'm kind of trying to remember. But there's a clear tone in Hosea that at least jumped out at me here that I don't know if we've seen before, where it's not just that God is angry, it's that God is like forlorn at the betrayal of Israel.
Yeah.
I feel like, and we've talked before, and I don't really know how to put the timeline together here, but we've talked before about how, like, the God of the Hebrew Bible sort of growing up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, when we were in Genesis, he, I don't know, there's a sense he has no idea how to deal with humans, and his approach is changing.
Yeah.
It feels like the approach is changing a little bit here, in like almost a good way, but still kind of a toxic way, where like there is this sense of like, no, but I actually really, you're the one I want. Like, there's this memory of Israel when Israel was younger, and like he's sort of, God's like pining after this relationship. Did that tone feel different to anyone else, or is that just something I've noticed because of all the harlot language?
No, I think you're right. And I think it's great to recognize that, because even though it might be bound up in misogynistic language that we don't like,
yeah,
it's useful to recognize that Hosea is offering just a very different view of who God is,
right,
from other places. I mean, the God of Amos cares about justice. This God cares about fidelity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is the word,
yeah,
right, for this,
yeah,
and for the entire metaphor. And so some terms are going to come up in here. For instance, you might have noticed, or maybe not, but there's a Hebrew word, chesed, which is often translated in the King James as loving kindness.
Yeah.
And here it's translated in a couple of different ways. It actually appears like right at the beginning of the second section in 4:1, as loyalty. And chesed is difficult because it has no actual translation into English, and it's much debated, and different people have different feelings on how it should be related. But the idea is it's a sort of kindness or loving covenantal obligation. So the same way that you should exhibit a sympathy and pity for your children, that you owe them to raise them up, you owe them everything they need that's necessary for their care, that God feels chesed for Israel, the same way that Hosea feels chesed for Gomer, right? Gomer. And this word is going to keep coming up kind of, and often translated different ways in English, which leads us to the problem is then you can't see the shades of it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because it will be mentioned like in 6:6 again, and we'll get to this, but its tone will change between what Israel owes God and what God owes Israel. So God very much has a fidelitous relationship that has been broken. Totally different from what's being talked about in Amos.
Yeah.
But again, it's a hard source, and some of that just doesn't come through in English. So
yeah. And it feels to me like, and again, I don't know how to put it in its chronological order, but I can start to see this to where it's building to where you can imagine a Judaism that can accept the idea of God coming to rescue them in the form of Christ. Because there's now this sense of like, not just anger at covenant broken, but desire to have Israel. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think what we're seeing, and we've discussed it a few times, is this notion that what's going on is a project to explain the bad fortunes,
right,
of God's chosen people. And Amos has one explanation, that the people need to be more humble and care for those who they've overlooked, that those are chosen people too.
Right.
Hosea is going to approach it from a very like covenantal perspective, that they're married. Israel is the bride of Hashem. And so we're going to have to pick through that metaphor as you read it. But the story is it ultimately is very hopeful, because Hosea goes back for Gomer.
Yeah.
And God says, well, I will go back for my bride too.
Right.
And it's a weird metaphor. It doesn't really work by our standards. Like, I really don't like it as a metaphor, to be honest.
Yeah, it's a terrible metaphor by our standards. Yeah,
it's. I mean, not only in the sense that it's misogynistic. Like, let's bracket that.
Uh-huh.
Not only in that sense,
yeah,
but also in the sense that if we just say it's a parent-child relationship, it's still awful.
Yeah.
It's horrific. God is like the worst parent.
Right. And that's what I mean by like still kind of toxic. Like I feel like I'm starting to see development of like a more loving relationship with Israel, but it still has this toxic sense of like, I'm going to redeem you by selling you to slavery for a while. Right. Yeah. Like it's a toxic kind of almost lustful longing rather than like a genuine caring love. And yet I like trying to put it in its developmental context, and maybe I'm just being too optimistic, but trying to see how that might be allowed to grow until Hashem grows to mean something more mature or something more beautiful.
Yeah. And remember that whenever we read about God or any God, we're seeing a projection of the culture that believes in that God.
Right.
And so one thing that we could see as a development is the idea that this is not some remote, you know, far pastoral God. Yeah. This is not a God of rocks or land. This is not a God who's angry particularly.
Yeah.
It's a God who is spurned.
Right.
And it is a closer familial relationship, that it's not just a God that has extended patronage. Now, we've seen models like that based on like Assyrian and other Near Eastern legal codes, where God is the suzerain over a vassal, right? That God is this distant lord ruling from Damascus or whatever. This is a God who is your husband, which is closer to what we would recognize.
Right.
So, yeah, I think that's one reason we need to look at this text, even though the way it's couched is kind of an uncomfortable middle, right?
Like, yeah, right.
We went from like a God that's comfortably remote to a God that's like, we're trying to get to a God that's comfortably close, but on the way we're like, oh, it's like a really weird uncle.
Who like you're kind of grateful to for bailing you out, but also like he's really inappropriate.
Yeah. And so
he helped you get through college, but you never want to see him again.
Yeah. Paid for your tuition, but
I'm having too much fun with that metaphor.
But he pinched your butt at a New Year's party. Right. So you're just like, what? Do I owe this guy something? So it's a hard text for grammatical reasons, for content reasons, but it does represent a development of a theology.
Yeah. So I don't want to spend too long on this, but before we move on, I have one other question. Because I've been reading these, I'm trying to figure out how to read them kind of in two ways. One is, like you say, there's this real person who probably has at least, the text has at least some origin in the time that they're describing. But these texts are also part of a debate that's happening later about why Israel fell, why Judah fell, right? Yeah. And we see, like you said, it's couched, this is like written to Judah.
Yeah.
And that's probably editorialized later, but it's being bracketed for that. So that is right to think about it in both ways, right? So I should also be thinking of this as like, okay, we're in captivity now, and this and Amos are, I might read both of these texts and understand them as two different arguments for why the captivity happened.
Yeah. And you should always think of any history as being at least two histories, which is the history that it's written about and then the history of the author.
Yeah.
Now, in the case of something like this, you also have to recognize that it's also a history of the editors.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And maybe multiple layers of editors.
Right.
Which can make it super hard to pick apart. So as you're reading, it's useful. I mean, that's one reason why those verse by verse scholarly monographs where they like, okay, this is later and this is earlier, and that's all theory, right? But the reason they're doing that is they're trying to pick apart two or even three different authorial models, because it's three histories. This text is at least three histories.
Yeah.
Because it has
Hosea, the original.
Yeah. Whatever Hosea is intending to tell us is the first history. The history of Hosea is the second history, kind of the non-deliberate history.
Right.
And then the editorial history.
Yeah.
And in technically you could go to fourth. What is the real history? Not the ones the editors are trying to tell us. So you can, and this is something that textual historians and textual critics do for every document. And I mean, there are people who specialize in like one book. And have like one peer in the whole world because, and their journal debates and reviews are like two people arguing. So it can be very hard to pick through. Now, of course, I don't think any of us here, myself included, should be expected to know, able to pick it apart to that depth. But certain little clues in here are pretty obvious.
Yeah.
Like that opening superscription, right? Like, it's just not written to Israel, which is super weird for a guy that is writing to Israel.
Right. This is fun.
Good.
All right, so let's jump into the text. So we start, as we said, with this metaphor, not a metaphor?
Yeah, I don't know.
I hope a metaphor. The Lord said to Hosea, go get yourself a wife of whoredom and children of whoredom, for the land will stray from following the Lord. So he went and married Gomer, daughter of Diblaim. She conceived and bore him a son, and the Lord instructed him, name him Jezreel, which means...
So Jezreel doesn't have like a
straight
meaning, right?
Okay.
It's because Jezreel is the city where Jehu...
Oh, that's right.
...did his coup, and he's the ancestor of Jeroboam II. So basically you're naming him like, this is the coup place.
And
you're like, I'm going to name my child Capital Rotunda on January 6th.
So help me remember though, which despite having just covered it, my Israelite history is still bad. So this is which coup? Remind me the story of this particular coup.
So Jehu is the one who goes and like wipes out basically the Omri dynasty.
That's
right. And the Omri dynasty is the one who wiped out the Davidic dynasty.
Yeah, like up in the north. They had taken over from like Rehoboam's dynasty. Mm-hmm. And so Jehu goes and he kills them, and he's also killing like his allies in the south, and he ends up being so really a bloody rise to power. And his dynasty will be around none of these dynasties are around that long. But Jeroboam II is his eventual successor. So by naming his child Jezreel, it's this big reminder that the entire kingdom's apparatus is illegitimate.
Right. That is kind of what I took from it, but I wanted to make sure that I understood that I was remembering my coups well enough to get that message. Then there's more kids who are named things like...
Lo Ruhama?
Yeah, which obviously means...
Not pitied.
Yeah, and that's kind of it's one of those words that can also mean like loved, forgiven, not felt compassion for, things like that.
Not loved, not forgiven.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
And then we have a son, not my people.
Yeah.
Which I guess kind of goes with the illegitimate theme here.
Yes. And it's reversed, right? Like in chapter 2, and the number of the Israelites shall be like the sand of the sea. And so this sense of restitution that cannot be measured and cannot be counted. And it shall happen, instead of it being said to them, you are not my people, it shall be said of them, children of the living God. And so you say to your brothers in verse 3, my people, and to your sisters, she has shown mercy. So it takes their name and removes the lo, the negation. So their names there are just Ruhama and Ami.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so like you said, there's this real sense of hopefulness.
Yeah, eventually.
Eventually, yeah. Well, and it's all mixed together, right? I mean, this is why I'm talking, like, it feels beautiful for a minute. We've reversed it. My people lovingly accepted. That's how mine translates to your sister, lovingly accepted. Rebuke your mother, rebuke her, for she is not my wife, and I am not her husband. And let her put away her harlotry from her face, and her adultery from between her breasts, else will I strip her naked and leave her as on the day she was born. And I will make her like a wilderness, render her like desert land. So it's oscillating between this invitation, like this inviting tone, and then very threatening tone.
Yeah, and there it's tricky because there are shades of violence in it. But at the same time, like, so the thought of many scholars is that when it says, like, take the whoring from her face, that a prostitute, a sex worker, would have put coal around her eyes and reddened her lips and put in a nose ring. So to remove whoring from one's face is literally to remove the markings that establish one as a sex worker in the Near East. The same for, like, where it's, like, talks about, like, she has to remove the adultery from between her breasts, that she would have put like a perfume on herself.
Okay.
And so like the idea is like otherwise I will strip you naked. So not saying necessarily that this violence will occur, but that there needs to be a physical transformation in Gomer. Otherwise, as the husband, Hosea does have the right to go and take out her nose ring and wipe the coal from her eyes and, you know, take off her lipstick and her fragrance. So it's not just like ripping off her clothes. It's like literally removing the things that mark her as available to other men. So there's weird little tech context like that that can make it less abusive sounding. I'm not sure I buy them all, because part of the problem is we don't know how much of that is later explanation and how much of that is really rooted in like prostitute practices.
Yeah. So, well, even the way you describe it there, it's unclear how abusive it would be. Because if you choose the meaning that he's sort of redeeming her and like this is a consensual like coming back into relationship, then it could be quite beautiful. But you could just as easily, even if it is markers of prostitution, take the meaning that he's forcefully bringing her back into relationship.
Yeah, and this is hard. Like at the very least, I think it is good that this isn't explicitly violent. Like this text doesn't get used as an excuse for domestic violence very often. it doesn't stretch that far in that direction.
Very often.
Yeah, only occasionally.
So, did we just differentiate this verse from other verses in the Bible by how often they get used for justification for domestic violence?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That happens.
A pleasant way to distinguish them.
So,
moving along into, I don't know. I feel like it goes back and forth in this kind of same sort of back and forth way, inviting these things are going to have to change. We're going to get rid of Baal. I will remove the names of Baalim from her mouth. They shall never more be mentioned by name. I think here my verses get different. So I like, in the King James at least, this is verse 19 and 20, but it's 21 and 22 in mine. I think this might even be one of the places where Hashem gets used. I will espouse you forever. I will espouse you with righteousness and justice and with goodness and mercy. And I will espouse you with faithfulness. Then you shall be devoted to the Lord. In that day I will respond, declares the Lord. I will respond to the sky and it shall respond to the earth. And the earth shall respond with new grain and wine and oil. So there's this sense of, well, and it comes right back to the names. I will take Lo Ruhama back in favor, and I will say to Lo Ami, you are my people, and he will respond, you are my God. It's just another kind of, I don't know, illustration of this back and forth.
Yup.
Then in chapter 3, do we suddenly change metaphors? Is this still the same metaphor? Like, who's this unnamed woman who Hosea is told to go befriend? Do we think this is Gomer still?
According to my Googling, there is some disagreement.
Yeah, that's kind of what my very limited, I didn't Google, but that's what my footnotes imply.
Yeah.
But anyway, regardless, yeah, scholars disagree on whether it refers to Gomer or to another woman. The texts are unnamed. But it just has the same feeling. Go again, love. So my footnotes say another translation of verse 1 could be, go again, love a woman who has a lover and is an adulteress. This is just as the love of Lord for the children of Israel who turn to other gods. So it has a strong sense of like God's trying to make Hosea like experience what it's like for God to have this unfaithfulness.
Yeah. I mean, I read it as it being Gomer because it talks about the redemption price, right?
Yeah.
So, but I mean, who knows?
So this is what you're referring to with him buying her back.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anything else we want to say about that before we move past the metaphor?
Like, for example, so as part of the metaphor, so you'll notice that he does pay the redemption price. So 15 weights of silver, an omer of barley, a lecta of barley. But then he says to her, you will dwell with me many days. You shall not play the whore, and you shall be no man's, and I too shall not come to bed with you for many days. And so the parallel being, he even spells it out, for many days shall the Israelites dwell without a king and commander. So they're not going to have conjugal relations, which in terms of Hashem is giving Israel a king, some sort of legitimacy.
Yeah.
So just as consummation is legitimacy in marriage, neither will the king be given to Israel.
Interesting. So Israel will have this sort of quasi-protected status. They're not just out slaving anymore.
Yeah.
But they're not fully legitimate either. They're not fully accepted back into the household yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. So then we get into a bunch of condemnation. So in chapter 4, I think, is where we get specifically the priests.
Oh, yeah. We bounce all over, don't we?
I mean, we bounce all over, yeah. But did you have something to...
No.
Yeah. So like chapter 4, verse 6, for example, my people is destroyed because of your disobedience. Because you have rejected obedience, I reject you as my priest. Because you have spurned the teaching of your God, I in turn will spurn your children.
So you're in 4:6 and you got destroyed for lack of what?
Obedience.
You got obedience? What do you have?
The better Hebrew word is knowledge.
Oh, because that's what mine has. Mine
that's
has
a really
knowledge.
Different translation.
Yeah.
Yes. It is. 4:1 is where he says, hear the word. So this is a legal claim, right? This is a lawsuit. And where he says, there is no faithfulness nor loyalty and no knowledge of God in the land. That word there, loyalty, is where we get the first big instance of chesed. So that's where we're getting into this nebulous. It's love, but it's a specific type of love.
What do you have in that? Because I have loyalty. What do you have?
In 4:1?
Yeah, 4:1. There's no faithfulness or loyalty.
It's pretty different because there is no honesty and no goodness and no obedience to God in the land.
I have faithfulness, loyalty, and knowledge in there.
So mine's consistently translating whatever yours is translating as knowledge. It's translating as an obedience.
Yeah.
Yeah. The word there, so loyalty, like Robert Alter renders it as trust. Mm. And he's better than most. The NRSV staff, the many NRSV translators. So difficult words there. But the Hebrew is not obedience. I mean, you can imply obedience throughout. You don't need the extra word. It is knowledge that there is something that they have failed to communicate or understand about God.
Well, do we have a sense what that is? Sorry.
Well, it's such an... Because you're in the Hebrew study Bible, Taylor.
The Jewish study Bible,
The Jewish study Bible, excuse me. And so it's interesting that would be...
Yeah.
So awry.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's got their agenda. I don't know what this one's agenda is. But
well, I mean, a lot. And Judaism is as diverse as many Christian religions, of course. So, I mean, there are sort of covenantal emphasizing Jewish people who want obedience.
Yeah.
And there's others who that's not the biggest priority.
Yeah. Do we have a sense what this knowledge is that they're lacking in?
Oh, that's a good question. What do you think, Dan?
Fair enough. Fair enough.
I mean, so in the part where in 6, which is what you were bringing up, right?
Yeah.
My people is destroyed without knowledge. For you, you rejected knowledge. And I rejected you from being a priest to me. And you forgot your God's teaching. I will forget your sons on my part. So...
I love reading different translations. Which translation is that you're reading?
This one is Robert
Alter's. That's Robert Alter's. Yeah, okay. All right, well, I'm going to kind of move through because I don't... At this point, like, I moved through pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So if you want to stop me where there's highlights that you want to point out...
Sounds good.
So we've got the corruption of the priests in 4. In 5 and 6, we have more denunciation and kind of a specific threat that I guess matches what the metaphor we just saw, where God's saying, I'm going to be slow to hear when you start to change. So in 6:1, the people say, come, let us turn back to the Lord. He attacked and he can heal us. He wounded and he can bind us up.
Where was that one?
That's chapter 6, verse 1.
So that whole unit, which is 5:8 through around 6:6, is specifically likely about the Syro-Ephraimite War, which you might recall was like a whole kerfuffle between Israel and Aram wanted to create an alliance against Assyria.
That's right.
But Judah allied with Assyria, and so they kind of fought with each other. So likely this is referring to that after attacking Judah, and Judah survived with Assyria's help, that Judah is contemplating a counterattack. So that's why you get this notion of, like, in verse 10, the princes of Judah have become like those who remove the landmark. On them I will pour out my wrath like water. Ephraim is oppressed, crushing in judgment, because he was determined to go after vanity. Many people think that that is the fact that the north sort of abandons their cause and is like, I guess we will be a vassal of Assyria. Therefore, I am like maggots to Ephraim and like rottenness to the house of Judah. So kind of belly aching about this whole war that has not turned out well for Israel. And near the end of that unit, we do get in 6:6, for I desire steadfast love and not sacrifice, that the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. That again, where it says that steadfast love is chesed. So again, lots of shades of what that might mean. Many people think chesed is the key to like making this thing make sense. Anyway.
So just to make sure I understood right, that the political thrust of the argument here is both that they shouldn't have gotten involved in the war in the first place, and then that they should have stuck to their guns and not run to Assyria for help.
So read 13. When Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah his wound, then Ephraim went to Assyria and sent to the great king. But he is not able to cure you or heal your wound, for I will be like a lion to Ephraim and like a young lion to the house of Judah. So he's complaining that these people think that they're going to find strength in Assyria as opposed to in Hashem. But Hosea feels differently. Now, Hosea probably doesn't know the situation. I mean, because if you're like, well, what if they had relied on Hashem? Well, they'd probably still have gotten wiped out, right? But so that's what Hosea thinks. We're going to see a lot of the literary prophets condemn these foreign alliances, this notion that Israel doesn't need alliances with foreign idolatrous nations. It can stand alone with God.
Yeah. Well, and Hosea is going to do that later too. Yeah.
Yeah. And that really, that's what he's saying right here too. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
So we're just looping in and out.
I feel like this is another place where it does depart a little bit from the Deuteronomist too, in that, while it is saying, like you say, that they should have relied on God, not other nations, which fits with the Deuteronomist, at least I think.
Mm-hmm.
But the way of staying with God isn't priests and sacrifice like it was for the Deuteronomist. It's this steadfast fidelity,
yeah,
and knowledge of God. So that is a place where I felt like there was a weak connection to Amos, and that they're both saying like, It's not the rituals.
Yeah.
And they have different answers for what it is, but they're both kind of saying it's not that.
Yeah. And I mean, the Deuteronomist didn't really care all that much necessarily it was about centralization, yeah, right? So this doesn't seem all that preoccupied with centralization.
Right.
Yeah. Very well then.
So then we have more in 7, more of this frustration with Assyria. God's offended that they're seeking alliances with Assyria. And I don't know, much more condemnation for more unfaithfulness. So in chapter 8, there's kind of a list of things they've done that are unfaithful. Early on in chapter 8, we get this idea of the illegitimate monarchy. They have made kings, but not with my sanction. That's verse 4. They have made officers, but not of my choice. Then we get graven images in the same verse of their silver and gold. They have made themselves images to their own undoing. They've courted alliances. So we're back to that. They've gone up to verse 9. They've gone up to Assyria. Ephraim has courted friendship. Verse 11, once again, it's sacrifice isn't going to save them. Ephraim has multiplied altars for guilt.
Can you give me your verse 9 again?
Like a lonely wild ass, for they have gone up to Assyria. Ephraim has courted friendship. Although it mentions,
yeah,
the footnotes say emendation yields for Ephraim has courted friendship. It says in Egypt they have courted friendship.
Yeah, it mentions Egypt in a couple of places. It's not quite as strong as Assyria. But Amanda was giggling because the translation in the NRSV is so different.
So 8:9, they've gone up to Assyria, a wild ass wandering alone, and Ephraim has bargained for lovers.
Oh.
Which is ties back to our allegory.
Yeah, that fits way better than courted friendship.
Yeah,
yeah.
And you're making me not like my translation.
Which is rare and interesting.
It makes more sense with the central metaphor of fidelity.
Yes.
Right? Like Robert Alter's is, they've gone up to Assyria, a wild ass on its own as Ephraim. They have made courtship's plea. So going and like begging for marriage.
Yeah. Which actually fits really well with the idea of like a big power that they're desperate to have their protection because they're afraid they're going to get wiped out. How much is Egypt still a big power at this point compared to Assyria? Are they?
They're big.
Okay.
Yeah. Egypt is pretty stable.
Isn't Egypt always Egypt?
Pretty much. Egypt is the biggest threat to Egypt is usually Egypt.
Yeah.
There's one line. Sorry, let me rewind just a little bit, Taylor, because there was one line that I wanted to mention.
Yeah.
This is chapter 6, verse 7, where I'm curious what your translation says, Taylor.
Chapter 6, verse 7?
Mm-hmm.
But they to a man have transgressed the covenant. This is where they have been false to me.
Okay, so most English translations that are Christian do it as, but like Adam, they transgressed the covenant.
Oh.
But you might remember that Adam just means man.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so it pretty much means humankind.
Yeah.
This is not an appearance of Adam randomly. Some creation myth or first man myth. It is saying humankind, but because it has Adam in the word, Christians are like, oh, Adam.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to offer that word of caution to our many people reading along verse by verse.
So jumping back to chapter 8, there's also, again, this sense of insincerity in their sacrifices. So verse 13, when they present sacrifices to me, it is but flesh for them to eat. The Lord has not accepted them. Back to Egypt with them. let's see. Then we get in chapter 9, again, more condemnation for pursuing a harlot. Send them back to captivity. Sacrifices aren't going to do it. They're going to have access to the temple. Did I get that right? So chapter 9, verse 4. Their food will be only for hunger. It shall not come into the house of the Lord. What will you do about feast days, about the festivals of the Lord? Moving to chapter 10.
Right. More condemnation.
More condemnation. Specifically about the monarchy. And then we get this sort of, when we get to 11, we get this sort of, kind of a retelling of, in some sense, of Israel history, just like little snippets. And this sense that God is pining after earlier times. So chapter 11 opens, I fell in love with Israel when he was still a child, and I have called him my son ever since Egypt. Thus were they called, but they went their own way. They sacrificed to Baalim and offered to carved images. I have pampered Ephraim, taking them in my arms, but they have ignored my healing care. Anyway, it kind of goes on like that, where there's this sense of God's remembering back, and that brings out his tenderer side.
Yeah.
And we even get some like random specifics, like chapter 12, the story of Jacob wrestling the angel.
Mm-hmm.
In the womb, he tried to supplant his brother, so Jacob and Esau. Grown to manhood, he strove with a divine being. He strove with an angel and prevailed. The other had to weep and implore him.
I have a question on timing. Mm-hmm. So in what in mine is 11:12? Ephraim sucks, the house of Israel sucks, but Judah still walks with God and is faithful to the Holy One. Are we layering in there and editing by Judah but before the captivity and then other editings later post-captivity?
Very possibly.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
So if you're wondering about timeline, remember that this likely, so it's written pre-Assyrian captivity, but post-Assyrian captivity, the sacking, it's taken down by refugees likely into Judah. And then as part of Josiah's reforms, maybe this becomes its first big round of editing and repurposing occurs. And then its meaning will shift further later.
Yeah. When Judah also falls.
Correct.
Yeah. This has really helped me enjoy these books more, to think about these layers and like the conversation that's going on And the way it's repurposing old conversations to try and understand their history. And anyway, that's it's all very fascinating.
Well, and to have stuff like this verse that it's, we've got so many chunks that are clearly written post Judah's captivity, and that like an editor just missed this one. That as bored as I was reading Hosea, some other editor whose job and divine quote unquote calling it was to edit this missed that verse too. And like to have that knowledge enables me to be able to be like, you know what? An editor missed that.
Yeah.
Multiple rounds of editors missed that.
Is it possible too though that they didn't miss it? But I my sense is that the dislike, the sort of ethnic strife between Judah and Israel persists beyond the captivity of both nations, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we're seeing that in Samaria, and then the Samaritans in the New Testament, right?
Yeah.
So is it also possible that this was maybe written earlier, but it was left in because the Judahite redactors were fine with Judah looking better than Israel, even though they both fell in the end.
It could be. I mean, so that verse is likely at least a Josiah era addition, right? Because just a few chapters ago, we got plenty of condemnation for Judah.
Right.
And now Judah is walking in God's favor. Okay. Even though Judah is being infidelitous by courting foreign nations too.
Yeah.
In fact, it was kind of the first one to do it.
Right. And that's how Israel got sucked into the whole thing in a sense.
And so... Yeah, so likely we're seeing at least two layers. Now, did someone miss this in the post-exile, or did they choose to leave it in? Both are possible.
Yeah,
I like to tell myself that sometimes they just miss stuff.
They do make mistakes.
So it's okay for me to ignore that, because you missed it too.
I do like the story you weave that I'm just being bored.
Every long paper I've ever written, there's been some chunk that I went back and like, oh, I was not paying attention there.
Yeah.
So I figure that's just humans. We've been doing it forever.
Yeah. So did you have any thoughts on why? So I was curious about the particular instances that come up. So in chapter 11, we start with Egypt, which makes sense. How can I give you up after all of that? Then we go back even further when we get into 12 to Jacob. Like, why is, I guess because Jacob is the one that got renamed Israel. So I guess is it just that simple? Maybe it's just that simple that probably picked Jacob.
Jacob is the one who married the Lord. So right. at Bethel, Jacob is the one who abandoned all foreign gods in favor of Hashem.
Okay.
So in this metaphor, Jacob is the original bride, right, so to speak.
That does bring it together a little bit more nicely. So then, as you would expect to follow that, there's a condemnation for their lack of fidelity. They're going after other gods in chapter 13, seeking unauthorized kings. We're getting obviously some repeat here.
I just feel the need to point out in 13 too. So they keep on sinning, make a cast image for themselves, idols of silver. Sacrifice to these, they say. People are kissing calves.
Yeah, his little like, oh.
And an exclamation point.
Like his little pearl clutching moment.
Yes.
People are kissing calves.
It's always just nice when to pay attention to when we toss out the exclamation points. Like, what are we super irritated about today? Carry on.
On that note of the idolatry and the shock of it, it is interesting to see in the literary prophets. I do feel like there's a more solid monotheism, or at least it's growing more. And I just noticed that in verse 4, only I, the Lord, have been your God ever since the land of Egypt. You have never known a true God but me. You have never had a helper other than me. Although that could still fit, I guess, in some sense, if it was just their helper.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm always interested to see that development as well.
Yeah.
And then we get the hope again. It ends on this hopeful note. So, for example, chapter 13, verse 14, from Sheol itself, I will save them, redeem them from very death. Where, O death, are your plagues, your pestilence? Where, O Sheol? Revenge shall be far from my thoughts. So when I save you, it won't be for vengeance. I mean, it's back and forth a lot. But again, in 14, return, O Israel, to the Lord your God, for you have fallen because of your sin. Return to him, ask for forgiveness, and there will be restoration. And Ephraim will say in the end, what more have I to do with idols? When I respond and look to him, I become like a verdant cypress. Your fruit is provided by me. And then we get this postscript. These are my favorite kind of postscripts. If you're wise, you'll like what I said. I'm sold. I want to be wise. If you stumble, it's because you're wicked. Anyway. Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Third Hour Podcast.
Thank you for joining us. This was the Third Hour, a Latter-day Saint home study podcast. If you felt any impressions or had any comments, we would love to hear them at thethirdhourpodcast.com. We'll see you next time.